show today, we have a very interesting topic. And we have these two amazing guests, Pam O'Tal and Anasuya Kabat. I said it right?
You did.
Okay. All right. Awesome.
Perfect.
So these beautiful ladies are from Daya, Houston, and we are going to talk about financial abuse today. So when most people think of domestic abuse, the first thing that comes to mind is likely verbal abuse and physical assault. But research shows that financial abuse occurs just as frequently in unhealthy relationships as other forms of abuse. In fact, a study by the Centers for Financial Security found that 99% of domestic violence cases also involved financial abuse. Additionally, financial abuse is often the first sign of dating violence and domestic abuse. Consequently, knowing how to identify financial abuse is critical to your safety and security. We have Daya Houston today, whose organization, whose mission is to empower South Asian survivors of domestic and sexual violence with culturally specific services and educate the community to end the cycle of violence. So let's dive in. What is exactly financial abuse?
Right, so great first question, and we're so glad to be here today. So financial abuse is a common tactic used by abusers to gain power and control in a relationship. The forms of financial abuse may be subtle or overt, but in general includes tactics to conceal information, limit the victim's access to assets, or reduce accessibility to family finances. And financial abuse, along with emotional, physical, and sexual abuse, includes behaviors to intentionally manipulate, intimidate, and threaten the victim in order to entrap that person in the relationship. In some cases, financial abuse is present throughout the relationship, and in other cases, financial abuse becomes present when the survivor is attempting to leave or has left the relationship. And financial abuse, while less commonly understood, is one of the most powerful methods of keeping a survivor trapped in an abusive relationship and deeply diminishes the victim's ability to stay safe after leaving an abusive partner. Surveys of survivors reflect that concerns over their ability to provide financially for themselves and their children was one of the top reasons for staying in or returning to an abusive partner. And with all forms of abuse, financial abuse occurs across socioeconomic, educational, racial, gender, and all ethnic groups as well.
Okay. And what are some warning signs or red flags that people should be on lookout for?
So this is interesting because, you know, when it comes to abuse in general and specifically with financial abuse, these things don't just happen overnight, right?
Right.
Sometimes it can be really quick, but it's something that kind of builds up over time. And so, you know, it may start just real, almost unintentionally, right? Like as life gets busy, kind of divide and conquer in a relationship. And sometimes one partner is taking care of the financial duties, and slowly but surely over time, the other partner is left out of those duties where they even don't have any understanding or knowledge of it. So when it comes to maybe some of the red flags or warning signs, it's how much information do you have? How much access do you have to your financial records, your data, where accounts are located?
Yeah.
You know, every time people get monthly statements, do you get to see those monthly statements? Do you get to understand where the money is going?
Right.
And so those are just some really simple signs of, hey, am I still involved in this part of the relationship? And, you know, am I getting information and understanding of it? So, you know, I think sometimes the partners may not be explaining what's going on. Maybe they're just saying, oh, hey, just sign here. Or, hey, don't worry, we'll talk about it later. And then that never comes around. Or when questions are asked about, hey, why did we do this? Or what does this mean? Maybe there are those kinds of questions are received with condescension or blaming or mind your own business or that doesn't concern you. So even shaming in those kinds of ways. So, you know, I think in when it comes to relationships, everybody should have an understanding of where their finances are going. And so when you're seeing that with hate or shame or embarrassment, right, or things like that. Those are all subtle tactics that are used to kind of assert control on the financial side as well.
Okay. But so generally, I'm just thinking, because in our South Asian community, women are like, there are roles, right? Like men, exactly, are working and providing for the family and women take care of the household. So do you see that happening in those circumstances, or happening where women are working too? And then, you know, there's one person trying to take advantage of that, of the financial thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Pam, what do you think?
Yeah, no, definitely. Like, I think we'd like to think that if it's like financial abuse happens, like to people who don't have any sort of literacy, they don't have, right, any income, yeah, they're not working.
Yeah.
Like, we think of it as
something, or, and
like,
they're this not very educated, specific, or, you, yeah, know.
But, yeah, that's not true. Like, you kind of touched on this a little bit, but yeah, in our culture, in the Desi community, it is very kind of along gender lines. Like the men, they, yeah, take care of the finances, and the, right, women, like you, yeah, said, like they take care of like the children.
Yeah.
And because of that, I think just it's so normal for there to be, like, for women to not really have access to finances, or not to feel like they are even supposed to, yeah, have access.
Or understanding.
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So,
well, okay, and you also kind of think about just even your own personal situation.
Right.
How many bank accounts do you have? How many credit cards do you have?
Yeah.
Life insurance policies,
yeah,
mortgage on the house, things,
yeah,
like that. It can get spread out really,
yes,
quickly.
Yes.
And so if there's like, not that kind of, even if you're earning money,
yeah,
you, there's things going on in the background with,
right,
your finances that you might not always be involved with, but how are you staying kind of abreast of the situation,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
getting information? I don't think it matters if you're the income earner or not, you,
yeah,
still need to be involved.
Okay. What are the most common forms of financial abuse that exist within the South Asian survivors of abuse?
Yeah, so whether like subtle or kind of very overt and obvious, there are kind of three overarching types of methods that abusers use to gain and maintain financial control over their partners. The first is preventing survivors from using their financial sources. So this could be like withholding the money, not allowing them to have access to bank accounts, like hiding or lying about any, mm-hmm, assets that they have. Lack of access to utilities, so not letting someone access like the phone or the internet, and just,
wow,
kind of like a general lack of knowledge about like household finances and financial situations. And then the second kind of form is preventing survivors from obtaining or maintaining employment and education as well. And so this could be like forbidding the survivor to kind of work outside of the home, stalking them, harassing the survivor at the workplace. So like continually calling them, or like even calling their coworkers like, hey, she didn't call me. Did they get to work okay? Like,
yeah,
just that pretty,
yeah,
consistent stalking,
yeah,
forcing the survivor to be late, sabotaging the car, or like physically assaulting them before an important meeting. So they'll have to miss it, or they,
yeah,
will have to have to quit their job. And again, yeah, forbidding the survivor from getting a driver's license so they can go to work, or going to like this training, or like getting a degree that they want to get. And then that last kind of form is exploiting a survivor's resource to limit their financial and life options. So like forcing the survivor to sign financial documents, or forging their signature, making them kind of participate, whether unknowingly or not, in kind of financial fraud, like writing bad checks or filing fraudulent legal documents, pressuring them to be a co-signer or guarantor, coercing them to overspend on credit cards, forcing them to kind of like have that kind of coerced debt as well, personal information or assets used against their will or without their knowledge, and then also converting their partner's assets into their own. That can happen here or even like back home, like signing someone's like demeanor, I'm forgetting the English word for that, land.
Yeah.
Land over into,
yeah,
the abuser's name. And yeah, kind of just also kind of one thing we've seen in the South Asian community is also forcing the survivor to work in a family business with little to no pay. So yeah, if your partner does seem controlling about money, but you're not sure if you're a victim of financial abuse, just kind of see and like kind of think and reflect if you recognize any of these tactics that not only that I just mentioned, that also Anasia talked about in your own relationship. And keep in mind, all of these tactics don't have to be present for you to be in an abusive relationship. It only takes one. Like if you notice like, okay, well, this didn't really happen to me. But yeah, I think they are kind of forcing me to sign over a lot of my like financial documents or other things over to them. That is definitely a red flag. And of course, Daya is available to help. Please call our helpline at 713-981-7645.
Wow, that was a lot of different kind, right?
No, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It shows up in so many ways.
It does. Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, just thinking about it, like, you know, not knowing and then you're trying to sign off anything. But I don't understand, like, why would they want them to be in debt? So they're more dependent on the abuser?
Or also so that the abuser, they try to make it so that any debt that like that does kind of happen, yeah, it all goes into the name of the victim or the survivor.
Right.
So that the abuser, their credit history is still clean. Like if they need to go out, get a job, get a loan, they can still do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then that way this person, the survivor, is dependent on the abuser. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So are immigrants at a greater risk for financial abuse?
Yeah, I think we've seen that immigrants have certain nuances to the financial abuse that we see, right?
Yeah.
Especially with an immigrant's visa situation, employment situation. It's employment is tied up in their immigration status and so many different things. And so you can imagine if somebody wants to get a job, that's their way of getting income into the family, but it's tied to the immigration status of their spouse. That could lead to issues for them finding a job, you know, continuing with a job. And so that's one way it's a little bit kind of unique. And then another area, too, is kind of what Pam mentioned about, you know, accounts can be spread out in so many places, not just in the U.S., but with people's home countries. And so, you know, so many times you could think of, oh, well, my parents in India or my parents in Pakistan, wherever, they need money to do this. Yeah. We'll just send them money. And then the next thing you know, it's just, where's the money going?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then now it's not even in the U.S. and it makes it a little bit harder to track should a, you know, a survivor decide to pursue to leave the relationship. And so, so there are just things like that that we don't sometimes take into consideration when we think about financial abuse. But I think that's what is really important for what Daya is doing is, hey, we recognize that for immigrants, there are different things that make it harder to leave a relationship.
Yeah.
And so how can we help make that process a little bit? How can we provide resources to help navigate that kind of journey?
Okay. How does financial control, or shall we say financial abuse, play into broader pattern of domestic violence?
So financial abuse is definitely a kind of warning sign of, or kind of like precursor of things to come in a situation of financial abuse. There is a power imbalance in the relationship, and somebody is leveraging money and resources to control the other person. So because of this, financial abuse becomes very isolating as survivors become increasingly dependent on their abusers. And this financial dependence traps them in the relationship. So without resources, they're unable to kind of see a way out of their situation. So yeah, definitely financial control is in a lot of kind of ways, kind of that foundation of abuse that kind of happens in a relationship.
Okay. What are some ways abusers exploit survivors' resources?
Yeah, so as with other forms of abuse, financial abuse may begin subtly and progress over time. It may even look like love initially, like as abusers have the capacity to appear, you know, very charming and they're very masterful at manipulation. Like, for example, the abuser may make statements such as, like, I know you're under a lot of stress right now, so why don't you just let me take care of the finances and I'll give you, you know, money each week to like take care of what you need.
Mm-hmm.
So under these circumstances, the victim may believe that, like, that they should or can trust the partner that they are in love with and may willingly give over control of the money and how it's spent because they trust them. Yeah. And so this scenario commonly leads to abusers giving the victim less and less in allowance. And by the time the victim does decide that they want to take back control of the finances, they discover that the accounts have all been moved or that they no longer have knowledge or access to any family funds.
Oh, wow. That's just crazy.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah. What are some good first steps for someone facing financial abuse?
So when it comes to facing financial abuse, I think you don't have to face the journey alone. I think that's really important. There are resources like Daya that are there just for helping people in this situation. Yeah. And so, you know, the first step initially, though, is taking steps to kind of protect yourself and what you can do. So sometimes starting off with a phone call to Daya and just saying, hey, this is what I think is going on. The people at Daya are qualified to help and create a plan for safety in those situations. And so what is, you know, whether or not you have access to funds at that moment, yeah, Daya can help kind of create a plan for protecting yourself. So that's one important thing is, you know, you don't have to do this journey alone, even though you can feel really, you know, in a position of feeling really isolated and overwhelmed by how much there is going on. But if you can't leave your abuser immediately, there are some things that you can start doing to prepare for your future. So first of all, identify what resources that you do have. You know, if it's unsafe to take original copies of things like your passport or your IDs, your documents, you know, make copies of your financial data, your credit cards, financial statements, things like that, because those copies will actually be helpful in proving who owns what later on. Yeah. Keep this documentation in a safe place until you're able to safely leave. And, you know, start thinking of ways to gain access to your own money and building up some savings for yourself. So sometimes you can't do it all alone. Yeah. So identify and connect with other people that you can really trust who can provide support, whether that's family, friends, other family members, colleagues. You know, sometimes families are all across the country, all across the world.
Yeah.
But we hear of stories where, you know, even though the family is in a different place, they're still able to provide some sort of support.
Yeah.
You think about how much is digital these days and virtual. And so kind of taking advantage of those opportunities. And then the last thing to keep in mind is just prepare yourself mentally and emotionally for the journey, because recovering from financial abuse, like any form of abuse, it's just going to take a lot of time to heal. And, you know, we can and deal with the practical impacts too, not just like the emotional jarring of the fact that, you know, this trust you've put in other people has kind of been manipulated. And so there's going to be small steps. You're going to be laying like new bricks on a new house is the way I like to think about it, and giving yourself some grace and credit for, you know, what you're already getting through. You know, I think sometimes people are like, oh, I'm not doing enough, or, you know, there's just so much going on. Like, how am I going to do this all?
Yeah.
And it's not like you can, you know, jump to the top of the staircase or the top of the mountain in one step. It's a little, it's a process of getting there one step at a time.
And I think it's Daya statistics that it takes about 7 times for a person to get out of that relationship, right?
Yeah, definitely. And,
I mean, I can see that, because this can just be so daunting, you know, just to like, because you have been with that person for a long time, or even a little bit, but just mentally and physically to go through something like that, you need to be really strong and be sure that it's happening, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And sometimes, like, people will always say, like,
they talk themselves, like, out of it, right?
Yeah.
So,
and other people will always say, well, like, why didn't they just leave the relationship?
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Like, if they're facing this kind of abuse, why didn't they just leave?
Yeah.
Well, put yourself in those shoes for a second. If you didn't have a bank account, if you didn't have a credit card, if you didn't even have, like, the ID documents you needed to get those things, it's not like you can just up and leave. And, you know, sometimes it's not just based off of your situation. It also impacts your family, your children, too. So,
Yes, absolutely. What steps do you recommend for a person facing take in order to regain financial independence?
So I think it starts a little bit with what I mentioned earlier, which is, first of all, just, you know, when you're in a position where you start to feel a little bit more of that safety and comfort, you're going to be regaining your independence. It's going to start with just understanding what you need,
yeah.
you know,
yes.
and just setting up the basic vehicles for doing that. So, for example, maybe it's finding a job.
Yeah.
The second is opening a bank account so your income can go into that bank account.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so it's sometimes it's just these really, like I said, building blocks, like laying the bricks of a new financial house that you're building for yourself. And then taking some time to understand a little bit of basic financial literacy, meaning what do I need? How do I build an emergency fund?
Mm-hmm.
Just setting up a bank account of savings for those crazy things that happen, you know? So those are kind of some first steps. And then the second, and then from there you can build, like, okay, how am I going to, if I have a lot of debt now, how am I going to take the steps to pay off that debt? Is there ways to finance it, consolidate it, do whatever, you know, it takes to get it in a position that you can actually handle, you know? So there's like this road, this journey that you can start taking. And like I said, you're just biting off pieces at a time. So you don't want it to feel like you have to be, you know, all on your feet all at once.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just like that first step. Okay, we're going to get a job, open a bank account, get some income coming in, and then, hey, okay, now I need to take care of my expenses. Yeah. What expenses do I need to prioritize going from there? So,
one step at a time.
Yep.
Does Daya have any economic empowerment program? If so, can you tell us about it, please?
Yes, we do at Daya. We have our economic empowerment program, which was created to address the impacts of financial abuse and help survivors gain financial independence. So first, survivors work with our client advocates to apply for, you know, rental or housing assistance and get connected with direct financial assistance resources like grocery gift cards or SNAP benefits. And alongside, Daya clients will soon have access to our economic empowerment library of educational videos to develop the tools that they need to achieve financial stability. And these videos were filmed by Daya volunteers, and they provide basic financial literacy information. For example, like, how do I open a savings account, or how do I create a budget? And so these videos are like 2 to 5 minute max, minutes long. So the information is very like easily digestible. Cause like even for someone like me who, has had a lot of educational privilege, like some financial concepts, like I needed like very, like speak to me like a 5-year-old.
Break it down.
So yeah, clients will also be able to choose which topic they want to learn more about. And right now the videos are all in English, but we hope to also provide those in like Hindi or Urdu as well. And also Daya partners with organizations like Dress for Success and West Houston Assistance Ministries to support our clients' efforts to help them kind of gain resume building and interviewing skills, and community members and volunteers also help with that as well. And they also are great and reach out to us if they know of any job openings for our clients. And our aim is that this kind of comprehensive program and all of these efforts, not only from Daya and our staff, but community members and partners, will help financial abuse survivors overcome immediate economic barriers and secure long-term financial independence and safety. And like Anasuya said, like, it is definitely a journey. It's not something where you're getting into Daya, you're going to know everything the next day. It takes time.
It's learning little by little, right?
That said, I think, you know, we want people to know that there are so many different resources. Like, even if Daya can't help or maybe doesn't have the capacity to do it, there's so many different organizations that they partner with that help kind of fill in these gaps. And so sometimes the easiest thing is just establishing that connection with Daya so that you can kind of be directed to the right place, the right resource when you need it. And so I just love hearing about all the different organizations that they work with.
Yeah, I mean, and that's good to know to make that first step, right? Because you just, like you said, you never know where it's going to lead. You know, mm-hmm. you might come across some organization that can help you with something else as well. So, you know, because I'm sure there are like kids involved in these situations and they need help and, you know, they need their taking care of at school or those extra, you know, curricular activities. And I mean, we know a couple of organizations who do that. So I'm sure DIA has a wide variety.
Yeah. Right? Like people don't realize how many financial organizations are out there doing that can provide support in these really specific areas. So we just have to get started with DIA.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to be right back after the break. Thank you. Talking about financial abuse with DIA Houston. Do we have stories to share about our clients facing financial abuse?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad you asked. I think hearing a survivor's experience allows us to more deeply understand how financial abuse kind of actually occurs. And I have two stories I would like to share. So the first is client R, a 28-year-old woman with one young child. So during her engagement to her husband, he did not provide much information about his job or earnings, but told her he has a good job and makes a lot of money. And she didn't feel it was appropriate to kind of, you know, like press for more details. So when she arrived in the U.S. and began living with him, he kept all information about the family's kind of finances hidden from her. Mm-hmm. She did not know his income, and her in-laws kind of taunted her about, you know, the dowry and made her feel like she should be grateful that he, quote unquote, kind of like brought her to the U.S.
Yeah.
So he added her name to their apartment lease, but did not add her name to the bank account or credit card. And she never saw his tax returns or bank statements. And he gave her small amounts in cash every now and then to, you know, buy groceries or get things from the home. And he would also at the same time yell at her whenever he disapproved of any of her purchases. And he did not allow her to go to work or to get a driver's license or to leave the house without him. Mm-hmm. So later when he abandoned her and the child, she was left financially responsible to pay the rent as her name was the one on the lease. And mm-hmm. she had no source of income, no credit history, no bank account. And she did not know how the U.S. financial system worked or what her legal rights were. And he kept her financially dependent on him. And so whenever he was out of the picture, she felt very helpless and unsure of how to support herself and her child. Mm-hmm. So luckily she did call DIA and we've been able to kind of help her kind of regain and rebuild kind of her life and help her try to achieve that safety and stability. And then the second story I would like to share is a little bit different because I think a lot of times we think survivors, we think, you know, young women, but it can really happen to anyone. And so the second story is client M, a 58-year-old woman with two adult children. So she and her husband own a successful business. And as the abuse escalated, she decided to file for divorce. Mm-hmm. And during the divorce discovery process, when all, you know, financial documents are disclosed, she came to know that he had been taking out massive business loans in only her name using her social security number. Mm-hmm. And he even forged her signature a few times and opened up credit cards in her name without her knowledge. So as a result, most of their debt was now only in her name and not his. And she spent tens of thousands of dollars on legal fees to sort this out in the divorce case. But ultimately, the judge ended up dividing the debt in such a way that she was still liable for the debts that she didn't even end up consenting to. And yet, luckily, she as well was connected to DIA. But it's always, I think, if you feel like you are experiencing financial abuse or if there's anything that you feel like your partner has done that made you feel like, okay, I don't feel like I can fully trust this person. Yeah. Something you can do is run a credit history report mm-hmm. on like your social security number that you have. So you can find out yeah. what all the loans are. You can figure out where your credit is going, what's under your name. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely a great thing to do. And if you contact Daya, we can definitely help you get started with those kinds of processes.
Yeah, thank you for sharing the stories, because you're right. I mean, she's 58 and to discover that at that mm-hmm. age, right? That's mm-hmm. just so heartbreaking.
No, yeah, especially, like, yeah, like you're 58. Like I think, and also with our kind of not only Desi, but immigrant mentality, it's like you work hard all your life yeah. and then retirement you get to enjoy.
Exactly.
And so it's so hard whenever, you know, you face financial abuse yeah. and when you get to that age where you're supposed to enjoy.
Enjoy and not, yeah, you're still not fighting. But mm-hmm. I'm glad she reached out and she at least has a way to build it up. How do finances look in healthy relationships, and how should one address conflicts around finances as that could be a potential source of stress in a relationship?
Yeah, I think in healthy relationships, just in general, it starts with communication, right? And having just a mutual understanding of where things are going and not even just where's the money going, but what's going on in your life. Like, what are you guys working towards?
Yeah.
And so I think starting that communication early. And, you know, sometimes I always think life moves so fast, right? True. Like the weeks go by so quickly. There's always something going on. But taking some time every month, every few months to just take a look at, okay, what's the money coming in? What's the money going out? What do we own? What do we owe in liabilities? You know, where are the credit cards? Where's the insurance? So just really like everybody in the couple should have an understanding of what they have.
Right.
And if that's an open conversation, then, you know, both people feel empowered to make decisions for each, you know, with each other. And so that is, to me, what a healthy relationship looks like when it comes to the finances. And, you know, money can certainly be a stress in relationships. It's like, it's a well-known fact that money is stress. Yeah. Money causes stress.
Yes.
And so in terms of addressing conflicts around finances, I think, you know, being understanding of where this person's coming from, what are their desires and their needs, their wants for how they want to spend the money or use the money. And then I think just being really clear on what are your goals? What are you guys shooting for? We want to take care of the children. We want to make sure we have a roof over our head. We want to, you know, go on nice vacations every once in a while, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. But whatever it is, you know, setting that as the vision, and then seeing how your actions are really in line with doing that, you know? And if it's not really in line with it, then saying, hey, is that really what we want? Because, you know, money is a trade-off. Spending money or saving money, it's a trade-off, right? And so, you know, I think being really upfront about having those conversations and not being afraid to have those conversations is a great starting point.
Okay. What's your thought about getting an allowance? Like, I feel like I give allowance to my kids. So as a spouse, it's kind of offensive. Like, you're going to give me an allowance that I can spend. I mean, it belongs to both of us, right? So I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, to me, it's a little hard for me to understand having an allowance. It is hard for me to understand. I think sometimes maybe the way it's framed is not so much as an allowance as like a budget.
Yes, a budget.
Okay, you have so much to spend in the week or month. Why do you spend that? But allowance for spending on my own.
Absolutely. It's hard for me to think of that.
Right?
I think it's more of a budget. Hey, here's our budget for like our trip coming up.
Yes.
Here's our budget for this. And then if you're going renovating the house or something like that, you know, or whatever. Okay, if we're going over budget, what are we going to do about it?
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of maybe a healthy way of talking about it versus, okay, here's what you can spend and save on.
Yeah.
That's where the difference, right? Like, abuse is where somebody's asserting control over another person.
Both.
Right?
Exactly. One person.
Order.
This
right?
is what I think you should do, and you don't have a say in it. That's control over someone versus, hey, this is how we want to spend it together.
Together.
I may be the one doing that.
Yeah.
You know?
If you know someone who is facing financial abuse, what are some ways you can support them?
So here are a few things you can do, especially if someone is still kind of in the relationship or in the situation. So one, ask them what they need. So instead of like buying things for the survivor without asking, like kind of start by like asking like, hey, what is it that I can get for you? Survivors know best how to allocate money to cover their costs. For example, one survivor said they personally like needed a reliable car that could fit their kids. Mm-hmm. And adding like they added that it's important that the abuser doesn't know about the car. So kind of helping figure that out for them. Mm-hmm. And like it's kind of assessing with them, what is it that they need and how can you help them get that? And then two is to give cash instead of like electronic transfers like Zelle or Venmo, which I know is very popular nowadays. Yeah. So about 3 out of 4 survivors don't have a safe bank account. And more than half of survivors that were surveyed recently said that their abuser has monitored, accessed, withdrawn from, or controlled their bank account in the past. So cash is the safest way to help a survivor become economically empowered. And then 3, like with permission, you can even use social media to promote like crowdfunding efforts. Like if your friend or family member has a fundraiser on like a platform like GoFundMe mm-hmm. or Facebook, you can use social media to kind of help them raise funds. But first, absolutely make sure you ask for permission first to respect their privacy and their confidentiality. And then 4, tap into your professional network to find job opportunities. Abusers often have prevented survivors from working or having a job. And because survivors need to take more time off than others to tend to, you know, the physical and mental effects of abuse, 60% of survivors have lost their jobs. And survivors of gender-based violence often have gaps in their resumes and limited means to support themselves and their family. So by connecting your friends or family members to job opportunities or even job trainings, mm-hmm. that can definitely be a great step to helping them become financially independent. 5 is to help them try to help them stay accountable for debt payoff goals. According to FreeFrom, it's a great nonprofit agency that helps survivors of financial abuse. Half of survivors borrow money or put living expenses on their credit cards to make ends meet, you know, once they try to leave the relationship. And 45% of those survivors miss or make late payments, which negatively impacts their credit score. So if you're also trying to pay off your own debt or trying to stick to your own budget, like it may be helpful to for your friends or family members, colleagues, whoever it is that's experiencing abuse, to let them know that they're not alone in dealing with debt and kind of talk about it together and figure out strategies together so how you can hold each other accountable. And 6, offer rides in childcare so that survivors can access support services like DIA services or even attending support groups. So if a survivor doesn't have their own car or public transportation is available, like especially if you're living in Houston and suburbs, like mm-hmm. there is no metro bus coming to Katy.
Yeah.
So providing a ride is very helpful in helping them like access the life-saving services that they need. And if possible, if you can also provide free childcare, it makes it easier for them to attend these services or even go to support groups or even like go to their job or go for interviews.
Yeah. Wow. That's some good information. And what are some ways we can start to educate our community about financial abuse?
So let's be honest, no one likes talking about money and they definitely don't enjoy talking about abuse. I've never found anyone in my years of working at DIA who's like, yes, I want to talk about this with you. But unfortunately, that means many people don't even realize that financial abuse is an issue that we need to discuss. And it leaves victims also feeling too ashamed to speak up about it. Financial abuse occurs in nearly all abusive relationships and is the number one reason victims stay in or return to abusive relationships. Yet 78% of Americans don't recognize financial abuse as domestic violence. So we definitely have to break the stigma and start actually talking more openly about abuse and be open to learning about it. And preventing abuse definitely starts with education. The more we all become aware of what financial abuse actually is, how we can identify it and how to respond to it, the better equipped our community will be to support the different economic challenges faced by survivors, such as the cost of recovery, the stigma of, you know, having faced any kind of abuse, unemployment and debt. And DIA is committed to educating the public, especially our South Asian community, on financial abuse, which fundamentally impacts the integrity of safety of so many survivors. So we offer presentations to promote awareness of abuse and increase support of survivors in the community. And anyone can submit a training request form for their organization, for their workplace, for their place of worship, at diahouston.org/community-trainings. Okay. And we also believe community awareness initiatives via social media platforms are a very useful tools to educate the public about different economic challenges faced by survivors. So if you aren't already, please follow us at Dia Houston on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Okay. Many people have said the phrase that she stayed for the money. So what do you have to say about people like that, you know, comments like mm-hmm. that, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. For decades, survivors of domestic abuse have kind of been accused of this. And this phrase, she stayed for the money, illustrates a lack of understanding of how coercive control operates,
right.
The safety implications for women attempting to separate, as well as the finances required to separate and remain separated. And however, a further fallacy is also kind of at play, the assumption that the impact of financial abuse ends when the relationship ends. So whereas some abusers might use violence to control another person, financial abusers disempower their victims by cutting off their financial freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So even when a victim leaves a relationship, they often return because they lack the money and the financial literacy to support themselves and their children. The short-term and long-term effects of financial abuse can be devastating. In the short term, access to assets is imperative to staying safe. Without assets like cash, survivors are often unable to obtain safe and affordable housing, or the funds to provide for themselves or their children. And so with that realistic fear of homelessness, it's little wonder that sometimes survivors return to an abusive partner. Like, it is an honestly a very difficult situation. Like, should I stay in this abusive relationship or do I risk being homeless?
Mm-hmm.
And for those who manage to escape the abuse and survive initially, they face often overwhelming odds in obtaining long-term security and safety, ruined credit scores, sporadic employment history, and legal issues caused by the abuse make it extremely difficult to gain independence, safety, and long-term security. So on the outside, it may be hard to understand why someone stayed,
mm-hmm.
but the reality is that financial abuse is one of the most powerful methods of keeping a victim trapped in an abusive relationship.
What are some ways we can prevent financial abuse, and what advice can we you give to young couples who are just starting their relationship?
I think it goes back to just how do we talk about money
yeah.
in relationships and modeling good behavior
right.
to other people too. So, you know, especially now with dating apps and, you know, meeting people virtually and things like that, you don't always know about these people from a friend of a friend. And even when you do know them from a friend of a friend, nobody talks about money. Nobody really
yeah.
knows what's going on under the hood about people's finances. So I think at a certain point, it comes a time where you do have to say, okay, what does your income look like? What do your spending habits
yeah.
look like?
Yeah.
Do you save?
Yeah.
You know, like, do you save?
Yeah.
Seriously, and what are you saving for?
Yeah.
So, like, being really honest and upfront with your partner about, hey, this is what's important to me when I save. You know, I'm, you know, my background is in finance and investing in personal finance for a lot of families. And we always ask these questions, what's important to you about money?
Yeah.
You know, what keeps you up at night when you think about money? And
yeah.
like, I almost call these like the newlywed questions, because
yeah.
if you're not really on the same page about, hey, I really want to spend my money for experiences versus material stuff, things
yeah.
like that. Well, is that going to be – that's going to cause a lot of conflict later
yeah.
on in the future. And so these kinds of questions get the conversation going.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes it's not even just about like, okay, these are the numbers. Sometimes it's more about just like the high level conversation about what are you really working towards if this is really a relationship that's going somewhere.
Yeah, that's amazing because, I mean, I remember it's been 18 years I got married, but that was never a part of the, like financial. And then if you think about arranged marriages, you know, it's between families, right? Yeah. So I don't think this even crosses your mind, you know? So I think it's a great to, even when you're dating, to have these conversations to know, like, the personality, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you can see it in people's behaviors, too, right? Yes. Like,
but sometimes you're so blind by love or whatever it is that you put it on the side, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Absolutely. Or you just, like, we were talking about, where does it come from is, like, this trust, right? You have a trust in someone that they're looking out for your best interest and you're looking out for theirs, right? And so, but what is your best interest? Like, we got to talk about that, right?
Yeah,
so we do take it for granted, that's for sure.
Yeah. What is your advice for parents and how can parents include their children in these conversations?
So helping your teen avoid being financially manipulated by a partner starts with educating them about healthy and unhealthy behaviors. So as 13 to 19-year-olds move towards adulthood and independence, they began making decisions without parental or guardian involvement. They have their first romantic relationships. They might hold their first job or internship and start to handle their own money. So this is a time of new responsibilities and experiences that can be extremely challenging as teens begin to navigate the complexity of balancing their independence with forging these close relationships. And experiencing abuse during these formative years can have lasting harm or on future independence and well-being, particularly if such abuse impacts economic opportunity, like as it relates to education. And a recent study found that nearly one third of teen relationships show signs of financial abuse. So parents need to offer teens strategy to help navigate economic abuse and coercion that they may encounter in their own relationships to ensure they're able to pursue their career goals and be able to get to a point where they become financially independent. So it's important that parents take the initiative themselves to really try to engage their kids in these conversations and to make sure that they teach their boys and their girls how to be financially stable. However, not all parents or guardians are modeling healthy financial relationships for their teens to follow. So even if you just talk to them about it, you also have to show them as well, like follow your words with your actions. And so more than half of teens have heard their parents kind of arguing about money over the past month. And a lot of kids, they don't understand why the adults in their life make the financial decisions that they do. So include your children in conversations about budgeting, spending, and debt. Show them how you and your partner have shared decision-making for finances, how you have equal access to financial resources, how you support each other's academic and career goals, and also equitably divide household and childcare responsibilities. Like, dads, you have to wash the dishes too.
Yeah.
And again, early intervention in education during the teen years is critical to establish healthy and equitable economic dynamics within their relationships.
That is some great information and resources that you've shared, Pam and Anasuya. We really appreciate it. The time has literally flown by. But do you have any announcements to make before we go? And do you want to share how they can contact you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So at DIA, we are hiring. We're looking for a client advocate and a counselor. And more information about these positions, including how you can apply, is available on our website, diahouston.org. And again, if you or anyone you know is experiencing financial abuse or any form of abuse, please contact our free and confidential helpline at 713-981-7645 or email us at contact@diahouston.org.
Thank you so much, ladies. This was a wonderful show. And also the information shared, it was just great, you know. And I know people can go on the website and get more if they need to. And thank you, listeners.